Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We want to thank Mike Murphy for sitting in and engineering today in place of Beth Pike. On today's edition, Rebecca Hamilton talks with Tiffany and Brittany of One Struggle KC about their upcoming event marking the killing of Michael Brown, as well as other victims of police actions, and what can be done locally and nationally. Then, Allie Catherine Bush talks with Kim Case of the Missouri Sheriff's Association Crime Victims Unit about how they help crime victims and their families navigate the investigative and prosecutorial process. Please stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Coming up is Rebecca and her guest, Tiffany and Brittany.
Good morning. My name is Rebecca Hamilton, former prosecutor and now criminal defense and civil rights attorney. My guests are Britt and Tiffany of One Struggle. They're here to talk about an important anniversary that's coming up, and about an event they have helped to plan to honor that anniversary, so to speak, and other similar occurrences. I'd like to start with you, Britt. Would you tell us when and where this event is going to be and what the goals are of the event?
Our event is KC Defiance, which is being put on by One Struggle KC, and it is on August 9th. That's this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. The KC Defiance is at the median at 85th Terrace and Ward Parkway. And the purpose of KC Defiance is to call attention and to honor the lives of those killed by police. We especially want to remember Mike Brown because, of course, August 9th is the anniversary of when he was killed. But here in Kansas City, the purpose is to also honor the lives of those that have been killed locally. So we will be especially honoring Ryan Stokes and also Javon Hawkins.
We'll talk a little bit more about those two individuals from Kansas City. But before we do that, I wanted to ask Tiffany. We're having this on the anniversary of Michael Brown's death. Could you tell us maybe why Michael Brown's death was such a catalyst, such a turning point, and why we are having this event on that day?
Okay, well, on August 9th, as everyone knows, Michael Brown was killed by Darren Wilson in broad daylight in the middle of the afternoon. And as a result of his death, there was a peaceful candlelight vigil that evening where the local police force showed up in riot gear and they were ready for, basically, for a war. And they maced and they shot rubber bullets at the people of Ferguson. And the people of Ferguson stood up for themselves. And they didn't want to accept that treatment from the police state. And so that was the main catalyst, was the reaction to Michael Brown's death by the police that kind of sparked this whole movement. And people are, like, finally standing up for themselves and their mistreatment by law enforcement agencies.
So death by police wasn't a new thing, but what was new was people's willingness to say, you can't treat us like this.
Yes, where it's enough is enough. They left his body out on the street for 4.5 hours. And that was a ridiculous time for him to be out there, for his family, for his community to see him that way. And then when they want to have a peaceful vigil that many people have after they've been, the families have after they've been killed, it was peaceful, there was nothing, and the police came ready for war. And they instigated all this violence against those peaceful people, and people are like, we will not tolerate this any longer.
Tell me your personal involvement, your reaction to that news, and how you got involved.
It was very upsetting. You know, as many people, as black people here in America, we realize that the police, they they harass us for the color of our skin. And so me and my friends, we went down to Ferguson a couple months after just to see it for ourselves and see Mike Brown's memorial. We went to a city council meeting. We met the local protesters. We even crashed the governor's state press conference. And just seeing it for myself and seeing it like this is happening in Ferguson, but it's happening right here in Kansas City. And we need to bring awareness to those issues here in Kansas City because Kansas City is not immune to what's going on in Ferguson.
So 2 months later, the movement was building and drawing more and more people from across the country to get involved.
Yes, definitely. As we got closer to the grand jury announcement of whether there was an indictment or no indictment, momentum was picking up around the country. And we were just, you know, how can we, this blatant disregard for justice, how can we stand by and let that go? We can't let that go any longer. As the prevalence of personal cameras and cell phone videos show, like this is an issue that's been brought to the mainstream. But as black people, we know this has been going on for a very long time.
Britt, would you tell us what your personal reaction was to the news as you it was unfolding and how you got involved?
It, for me, started with social media, and social media has played a large part in this movement, especially because it's allowed people to connect all over the country and then even broader all over the world. That's one of the ways that Black Lives Matter has tied into this because it connected the people in Ferguson to people in Oakland and then here in Kansas City. And that's how I found out what was going on in Ferguson. The protesters on the ground started uploading images, and it was at that point we were able to see how they were being treated. And this is before mainstream media ever showed up to carry what was going on. We were able to see that they were being maced, that they were being hit with rubber bullets. And at that point, I felt drawn to go to Ferguson and to help the community of people there. Because again, these are black people. These are people that look just like me. And as Tiffany stated, black people have always known how we were treated by police, how we were treated by authority figures, the state. And so I was one of the friends of Tiffany who also traveled to Ferguson at the same time and had those same experiences. And getting to connect with the protesters there on the ground and getting the message from the people there in Ferguson that these same things that are going on here, they're not just here in Ferguson, they're all over. And learn this training and take it back to your own community and help in your community. And that's what I'm doing here in Kansas City.
Sounds like they were already getting a real strong basis of training and an ability to launch from there into the broader communities and nation and worldwide.
Well, that was what was special about Ferguson. Everyone who came and had that experience, it was an opportunity for us to validate all the things that we had always known, that we had been experiencing this harassment, we had been experiencing this brutality for all of our lives, and it's been going on for centuries. And we came to this place, we saw it again, the videotapes were allowing these things to go on, but we've always known this. And so for the first time, people of color were saying, we're not going to allow this to continue, and we're going to organize, and we're going to shift this country.
Tiffany, you talked about in a prior discussion that we had about information gathered about Ferguson and the discrimination that was going on in a variety of areas as far as law enforcement. And I understand that you have researched into those same areas in the Kansas City area. Can you share that with us?
Yes. During the Ferguson and during people protesting right after Mike Brown, we saw in the news there was racial profiling data in Ferguson and showing that black people in Ferguson were way overrepresented in traffic stops and traffic violations. But that information is available across the state for every law enforcement agency in the state. There was a law that was enacted in 2000 and enforced by, at that time, Attorney General Jay Nixon, who is now our current governor, that they had to quantify this racial profiling data by every law enforcement agency in the state. And so KCPD is not immune to that, even though, for example, in 2013, black people make up 28% of the population, and yet black people made up in that year 40% of the stops, 68% of the searches, and 69% of the arrests. While on the other hand, the actual contraband that was found in those searches, 26% was found by white people and 21% by black people. So even though we were searched and stopped more, white people were found to actually have more illegal things on them than black people.
Right. Yeah, you went through that pretty quickly. But, yeah, the bottom line is they were disproportionately stopped, and then even a bigger percentage are searched.
Yes.
And a bigger, much bigger percentage are arrested, yet the amount of contraband is the opposite. There's more contraband. So the statistics should be reflect that,
you,
one would think.
You would think so, but unfortunately that's not the case, and it looks that way every single year. And then in a previous forum we had with KCPD, we asked a couple of the majors, well, why is that? And what are you doing with this data that you have collected? And we didn't really get a good answer on that.
All right. Well, it's interesting that Jay Nixon was the one that instituted this compared to his reaction to the Ferguson situation. Do you want to address that?
Yeah, I was surprised and shocked when he – I understand there are pressures as governor that what you have to do, but you have to respect the people's First Amendment rights. And when you see there are clear violation of the First Amendment rights to gather and to protest and to assemble, you need to respond to that as governor versus executing the National Guard to shut them down.
Has anything happened? Has anything changed in terms of reactions to peaceful protest as far as you've been able to determine? Are they still coming out in combat gear, so aggressively, striking at peaceful protesters?
Yes, that appears to still be the norm all across the country. Protests are still happening weekly all across the country. And with each protest you can watch on live stream, it is the norm for police force to come out in full combat gear, and macing is still continuing to happen, and all that does is to energize more and more people to get active with protesting. So as part of that, One Struggle KC and groups all across the country have learned to do trainings. One Struggle just did one last week, a direct action training, teaching people about health and safety and how to prepare for protesting.
Can you give us a little sample of that, just to maybe one or two? Is there something that if you were talking to someone who hasn't had the training but wants to get involved, what's the key as far as you're concerned?
So the first thing I'm going to say is definitely go to our One Struggle page. It's One Struggle KC. And you can message us, and we definitely will send you a pamphlet about with basic information on training. But the type of things that you want to do is dress appropriately. You want to have on comfortable shoes just to prepare you for any scenario. You want to make sure you stay hydrated in the heat, drink lots of water in advance, and you want to make sure you go out in groups. So, of course, we have our KC Defiance coming up on August 9th. You want to make sure that you come out in a group of people. And if you are coming out by yourself, connect with someone else who's there just to make sure that people know who you are. You also want to make sure before you go that you tell family and friends that you're attending a protest and that people have contact information for you just in case you are arrested.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other individuals. You mentioned two from the Kansas City area. Could you tell us a little bit more about Javon Hawkins? Is that one of the Kansas City individuals?
So Javon Hawkins was shot by KCPD on July 9th and died on July 10th.
That's this year?
Yes, mm-hmm. Very recently, just a few weeks ago. And as of now, the Kansas City Police Department has released very, very few facts regarding the shooting of Javon Hawkins. all we know and all that has been released by the media, and that story has been put out mainly by the Kansas City Police Department, is that Javon Hawkins was seen in an area and was taking off his clothes. He was a 21-year-old black man, was taking off his clothes and was stating over and over, "thank you," while rolling around on the ground. And neighbors were concerned, called the police, and the police showed up, said he had a sword, but there are eyewitnesses that said that he may have been holding either a pipe or something else in his hand. They are not sure that he had a sword, and he was shot. The neighbors say that they heard four shots. The police say that he was only shot once. What is known is that he was shot in the stomach and died. And he was a 21-year-old black man. There have been numerous attempts by One Struggle KC and also by other community members to try and get more information on 21-year-old Javon Hawkins. And Chief Forte responded on Twitter by saying that he could not respond because he was looking into or working on a hamster. And that is all the information that we have gotten up to this point.
I remember seeing on social media the concern about a hamster being more important. That just seems like such a flippant thing for a chief of police. I'm sorry, I don't understand.
We don't either. When we saw it on Twitter, we were pretty speechless. To see that just blatant disregard when we're asking about a member of our community who was killed by police and wanting more information around those circumstances, to say, "oh, I'm taking care of a sick hamster, sorry I couldn't get to you."
That's perplexing why someone in that position would take such an offhanded way of responding. So this person seemed to be having either emotional breakdown type situation, or maybe it clearly not in his right mind for whatever reason. Do you know whether the police department in Kansas City has any training or any units that are supposed to be able to know how to handle that kind of situation?
They do, in fact, have a unit. Whether or not someone was dispatched from that unit, we have no idea.
And so it would appear, at least, that since deadly force was used and it's unclear whether there was ever any real danger to anyone, the officers, neighbors, anything like that, at least it doesn't appear to be the kind of situation that was handled correctly.
It does not appear that deadly force was warranted.
You're right. Let's talk a little bit about Mr.
Ryan Stokes.
Yes.
Ryan Stokes was killed 2 years ago in Power and Light District. And Ryan Stokes, honestly, his family has been extremely resilient in keeping his case at the forefront of Kansas City. They recently had a vigil on the anniversary of his death, July 28th. Just the short facts, he was in Power and Light with friends. There was a young white male from Johnson County that said, who was drunk, and said that his phone was stolen, his iPhone. The phone, in fact, was most likely lost. And there was the young white male accused a group of Ryan's friends having taken the phone. There was an altercation between Ryan's friends and Mace was dispersed by Kansas City Police Department. Ryan went back to get his friend's car, and Kansas City police officer shot Ryan. He said that he thought Ryan had a weapon. Ryan did not, in fact, have a weapon and was shot in the back, unarmed.
Okay, so he went back to get the car. Is he in the car when he's shot? Is he walking toward the car? Or what? I mean, he's just walking away from the scene? Or
yes.
Okay. And so how do we know that he was going back to the car?
He had the car keys, and his friend had asked him to get the car.
Okay. And so the officers are saying that they thought he had a weapon, so they needed to shoot him in the back?
You know, the details on that are still pretty foggy, and the family, you know, is going to most likely be pursuing more, so don't want to talk too much.
Exactly.
But there definitely are still a lot of discrepancies regarding Ryan's case.
All right. We just have a few more minutes. I'd like you to tell us again the time and place of your event.
Okay, our event is KC Defiance, and it's August 9th at 85th Terrace and Ward Parkway, right outside the Ward Parkway Mall. And we'll be remembering those killed by police violence. It's at 4 p.m., and we will be out there. Make sure you come out, stay hydrated, and wear light clothing.
All right, and just give us the list of names that you have on your brochure of other individuals that are being honored.
So we'll be honoring victims who've been killed nationally as well as locally. So that includes Mike Brown, Ryan Stokes, Tamir Rice, Ayanna Jones, Tanisha Anderson, Rekia Boyd, and Javon Hawkins.
And you do have brochures. What's your website or other ways that they can get in touch with you?
You can find us on Facebook at One Struggle KC. You can also find us on Twitter at One Struggle KC.
Let's do just briefly, do you mind telling us the story of the young child that was shot? That was so traumatic of a story. Could you just briefly tell us?
Which one?
Unfortunately, the little girl that was sleeping and got shot when they thought her grandmother had a weapon.
Oh, that was Ayanna Jones. So this happened in Michigan, and the police, they performed a raid on her home when, in fact, it was the incorrect home that they raided. And they came in with the, you know, flashbangs in her home. And as they came in, they thought the grandmother had a gun. And so the police officer shot into the house and killed 7-year-old Ayanna Jones, who was sleeping on the couch. Now, his case, he was indicted, but he was not convicted of any wrongdoing in that incident.
Okay. Well, we will be honoring many of the fallen, and we thank you so much for being here, for all that you're doing in One Struggle, in the leadership that you provide. So thanks again, and we look forward to having you again here on KKFI.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And now the Jaws of Justice calendar for August 3rd, 2015. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, August 3rd from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, Kansas City, Missouri. The Criminal Justice Task Force's mission is to lobby the Missouri legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and humane. For more information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, August 4th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be discussing the vigils for the scheduled execution and the October event with Sister Helen Preaching. If you are disturbed by the recent incident at the Adams Mark Hotel, there will be a rally and a march from the Missouri Tourist Information Center across the street from Kauffman Stadium, I-70 and Blue Ridge Boulevard, Tuesday, August 4th at 4 p.m. The incident involved a supervisor hanging a slave doll with a plastic trash bag in the employee's break room to mock the death of Sandra Bland. Although the supervisor has been fired, there are questions about how management allowed this display to hang in the break room for a day and a half. Mothers in Charge will have their membership meeting from 5 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, August 6th at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124, West 3200 Wayne Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. If you would like to become a member or are looking for more information, you can find them on the web at www.kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri will host their first Friday Forum Friday, August 7th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. This month's guests will be Ira Harrod and Mary Lackey, speaking about the Move the Money Listening Project, conducted by the Kansas City American Friends Service Committee. The Kansas City Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, August 7th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Parents of Murdered Children makes a difference through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness. They meet to provide support and assistance to all survivors of homicide victims while working to create a world free of murder. My name is Keith Brown Eel, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Listen in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio when Keith Brownell talks with Max Parthas of Move to Abolish 21st Century Slavery about the Constitution and the prison industrial complex. And then Richard Tripp talks with our own Melvin Merritt about the upcoming Penny Mill event for families on the East Side. Up next is Allie Catherine Bush and her guest, Kim Case.
This is Allie Catherine Bush, your host today on Jaws of Justice, KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in today. I have been treated for seasonal allergies for quite a while, so it was difficult to schedule our guest to be on the show today, but a third time is a charm. She's here today. Her name is Kim Case, and she's with the Missouri Sheriff's Association by telephone from Jeff City. Welcome, Kim. Tell us your position and the department that you work in that provides services to victims.
Yes, hello. Well, my name is Kim Case, and I serve as the advocate case manager for the Missouri Sheriff's Association Crime Victims Unit. We provide law enforcement-based services to victims of crime through police departments and sheriff's offices across the state.
Okay. The Missouri Sheriff's Association believes that law enforcement should be a defender of victims' rights. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. That is our goal and our mission. We exist to close the gaps that exist between the time of the 911 call and prosecution, that is, if there is prosecution that will occur. Our unit works to refer victims to local helping agencies across the state and to meet their needs through crisis intervention, helping them to find the right counselor. We accompany them to court, and we sit with them during the investigative interviews. We also help them in medical situations by responding to the hospital, and we are available to help transport them to appointments or court or anything that arises out of the victimization.
Okay. I might be asking you some redundant questions, but what types of complaints do you get in your unit?
We work with all types of victims. There is a statute that provides victims' rights to crime victims in Missouri, and that statute specifically speaks to victims of violent crime, like sexual assault, child abuse, robbery, murder, those types of things. But we also serve all types of victims, like elder abuse victims, identity theft victims, human trafficking, just about any kind of victimization that happens, we're available to assist and support them so that they know that they are not alone walking through the system.
Okay, that really sounds helpful to these people. What steps do you start when you do the first intake of the victim?
We typically are contacted by law enforcement to either respond to a crime scene and partner with them there, or they'll contact us during the next day or two so that we can get in contact with the victim and the family and follow up. Our first step is just to assess what has happened and some of the crisis that that brings into their life, like missing work or unable to attend different meetings and interviews and things like that. So we try to step into the crisis and help them maneuver their way through.
Okay, and what happens after this process?
Well, some cases are investigated and there may be an arrest made and then charges filed, which means the victim would have to maneuver through the criminal justice system. We are available to walk through that system with them, but oftentimes there is a court advocate that is available in the prosecutor's office, so we partner with them to make sure that the victim is aware of any court dates that might happen. We explain all the terminology and the different types of hearings that occur so that they feel that they're informed and they can prepare for what's coming.
Okay, and I know you want the victim to feel that they are really getting the services that they need. So I know it's important to your unit that the victim is treated kindly and with respect in every contact that you have during the process. Is the victim's complaint confidential?
Yes, their situation is kept confidential. The one thing that sets our unit apart, however, is that we do work directly through law enforcement. So if there is any case-specific information that comes up in our interactions, we have to let the victim know that we'll share that with the investigating officers. Some types of victim services, there's a level of confidentiality where the victims can really share a lot of different things with their advocate, and then those are kept private. But in our situation, because we are working through law enforcement with the hopes of making that system a little bit better for the victim, we also let them know that we have to share all information in a report to the investigating officers.
Okay, so in that way, do you act as a liaison between the investigators and the family to keep them informed of the progress of the case?
That's exactly right. That's our main goal, is to be that liaison. We find that oftentimes the victims, especially in those early days and weeks, a lot of questions come up about the process, and maybe they remember things that they didn't remember initially. And oftentimes it's difficult for them to contact the investigating officer due to the various shifts they work, or they may be out on other calls. Mm-hmm. So in order to lessen that burden for the victim of having to make numerous calls, we act as that liaison, as you described. So we'll take the information or the question and concern, and we track down the parties that would be, you know, available to answer that, and then we get the information back to the victim. Oftentimes, we find ourselves really in a listening position because victimization can be very traumatizing, and oftentimes the victim and their family really just needs to vent through the crisis that's happening in their life and the way that has affected them. So we find ourselves listening a lot and then helping to see needs and then meet those needs.
Okay. Is there any time where the media gets involved? You know, they want to know what has happened.
Yes, we do get a lot of media requests for facts on different cases, especially the higher publicized ones. And we're there to support the victims and letting them know that they're not required to speak to the media, that it's their prerogative if they want to make that decision. Most of the media, you know, in the Kansas City area does a really comprehensive job of respecting the privacy of victims and in trying to help protect them. But there is that need to sensationalize sometimes in cases, and so they want to get those interviews and so forth. But we see that that can be very re-victimizing for the victim. Mm-hmm. And so we try to support them and encourage them that it's their decision, that they don't have to you know, give interviews if they choose not to.
How involved are the witnesses or others in the process once you've been notified of an event?
We stay in touch with a variety of people that may have been involved in a victimization, from the actual victims and their family, and then also, as you described, some of the witnesses or some of the second and third parties that may be involved, because often we find that the crisis occurs in their lives as well. If they've witnessed a serious incident, even just knowing about something happening in your neighborhood or in your workplace can be very traumatizing. And so we try to allow them to be informed of the steps and know when court dates are and things like that, because it does help them to process the incident by attending court hearings and just following it through the system.
Now, with the caring resources that you have in the community, I know you must aid them in contacting those resources. What happens if the victim refuses to cooperate?
Well, that does happen, and there's a dynamic, many dynamics that would make that happen if they mm-hmm. chose not to participate. We are there to empower them to make the choices that is going to help them feel supported and encouraged. And sometimes that takes time. So even if we make an initial meeting with someone and we find that they don't wish to be involved or to participate in the system, we are still available to them at any later date if they would decide. We provide them information through pamphlets and through phone calls or meetings to some other agencies that might be available to help them.
Okay. Is there continuing contact with the victim?
Absolutely, and the level of contact varies by case. Sometimes we'll talk daily two or three times during the initial phases, and then things level off a bit as it lags in the system. Our criminal justice system can be quite slow, and if there's an investigation going on and not a lot of fresh leads, then there may be days or weeks that go by or even months where we don't have a lot of contact. But one of the things about our unit that we try to stay engaged with them through notes and cards and, for example, I have a mother whose son was killed in a rural part of Missouri, and unfortunately there's never been an arrest made and the case is still considered open, but I try to stay in touch with her monthly or at least on the holidays by just sending her a card, letting her know that she's not been forgotten, that her son has not been forgotten, and that it's still very important to us.
Jaws of Justice Radio, KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. We'll take a short pause here to let our listeners know that you're listening to Kim Case with the Missouri Sheriff's Association in Jeff City. My name is Allie Catherine Bush, and the subject is concerning the victims and how they are able to assist them through the process. Kim, can you tell us who some of these agencies are that you deal with most often?
Sure. Sure. I would say that we deal most regularly with many of the domestic and sexual violence shelters that are across Missouri. In each region, they exist to provide supportive housing and counseling and resources. So we partner with those very often. We also work regularly with children's advocacy centers that do forensic interviews for children that have been physically or sexually or emotionally abused. We work closely with their team of forensic interviewers and their advocates. We also find ourselves working very closely with the prosecutors in each county. As I mentioned, many have advocates that are on staff to help the victim maneuver that process, but there are some that don't in the state, and so we step in to assist them by supporting that victim and keeping them engaged and informed. There are a couple of other general victim centers, one in Springfield and one in St. Louis, and we work regularly with those centers as well.
Okay. I asked you earlier what happens if the victim refuses to cooperate. In this process, are they required to file a legal complaint to identify the offender?
Well, the most crimes that occur in this state would be a crime against the state rather than the person. So each county has the option to go ahead and file charges without the participation of the victim if there has been an interview and a statement made. But that really happens on a case-by-case scenario. We find that victims of the crime of domestic violence, often due to the dynamics and the emotional nature of that crime, often have fear for their safety, and so they are sometimes less likely to want to participate just because of the dynamics that have come about in their life with the violence and the victimization. But again, we're there to support them and empower them, and they're not, you know, required to file a report or follow up. So sometimes we do get calls from victims that say, hey, I don't want to make a police report, but this happened to me, and I'd like to know where I can go for help. And so we definitely help them as well. They don't have to necessarily be working with a law enforcement agency to get our help.
How did the Missouri Sheriff's Association come into existence? I know you have supporters, but when did that begin?
Yes, the Missouri Sheriff's Association began a partnership with the Missouri Victim Assistance Network, to which I was employed back in 2010 and 2011, and we were co-training in the area of sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse. And as I began to build a relationship with the administration at the Sheriff's Association, they really felt the need and the call to provide better services to the sheriffs, and even if they're in rural parts of the state and couldn't actually have an advocate on staff, they wanted to provide advocacy services to them. So they created the Crime Victims Unit, and starting in 2012, I believe, is when we were able to secure some funding through state and federal grants that have enabled us to build our team and our staff. And in fact, we're getting ready to apply for a new grant coming up this fall. Well, we will be adding 6 new advocates to our team to try to better serve the state.
Okay. You also have volunteers, I believe.
We do. We have a great team of volunteers, and they go through an intensive training that I provide where we talk about the basics of victimization and what that does to a person physically and emotionally. We talk about the different dynamics of different types of crime, and then they do interactions and ride-alongs with law enforcement and also with the court. It's about a 40-hour process, and then they can serve in many different ways. We have some volunteers that actually do advocacy work that will work with particular victims and help them, as I've described our services are. We have others that answer the hotline that we have, and they will then refer any cases that come in to me or to the other advocates. And then we also have some volunteers that help us with marketing items, any fundraisers that we might have, and that then are there also to help us stuff, envelopes and packets as we provide the resource information to law enforcement across the state.
Okay. I know that you're involved with ACLU as far as them supporting that the police departments give their officers those body cameras. Could you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, that actually, to be honest, sorry, it's not something that I'm specifically involved in with the Crime Victims Unit. That would be more with our administrative staff or people in different divisions here at the Sheriff's Association. So I don't want to misspeak to anything.
I'd like to read your mission statement here and your vision, because I think it's very important to a victim to understand that the Missouri Sheriff's Association is a nonprofit organization with a mission to support the office of the sheriff and the Constitution through legislative efforts, training, and technical assistance in its efforts to make communities a safer, more enjoyable place to live, to work, and to raise a family. And your vision goes on to say, to become a nationally recognized authority on issues affecting the office of sheriff, a formidable supporter of local control, and the premier law enforcement training provider to the state of Missouri through hard work, honesty, and dedication, providing sound research, strong legislative action, and superior quality service. Is there anything else you want to add to those two statements?
Well, I'm very proud to be an employee of the Missouri Sheriff's Association and to work side by side with our sheriffs and the law enforcement community in Missouri. They do put the needs of the citizens first, and I watch how hard they work each day to make their community safer. They constantly reach out to our unit in service for one of their victims so that they can make sure that the needs are being met and that they're able to process through the victimization. I'm very proud of what law enforcement stands for here in Missouri.
Okay. And Kim, could you tell our listeners how to get in touch with you, your website, phone numbers, or anything?
Yes. The Crime Victims Unit has a helpline that's sponsored by CenturyLink, and that number is 573-774-4357. We are available to answer that hotline 24 hours, 7 days a week, and they can also reach us by checking out our website link off of www.mosheriffs.com.
Do victims have to be referenced by law enforcement?
No, victims can contact us, and if it was a victimization from the past and no report was made, that's absolutely fine. We are here to serve anyone that has been affected by crime, even if it was in another state or even if it wasn't the actual victim that is feeling the effects. We are here to support and encourage and empower them to restore their life, and that's our goal. As you spoke in the beginning, the Sheriff's Association wants to be the defender of victims' rights.
Okay. Is this something that is also going on in other states? Do they have a sheriff's association like yours?
Well, there are sheriff's associations in other states, but not each one has a crime victims unit. I think that Missouri has been very progressive in seeing the gap that exists between the time of, say, a 911 call or a report and the time that the victimization gets through the system. There are other service providers across the country that may have similar programs, but I'm not aware of any that are located within a sheriff's association like ours.
Okay. Are people able to make donations if they want to support?
Yes, we are a nonprofit organization, and like our mission states, we exist to professionalize the Office of Sheriff and then to provide good resources for the community. So all donations can be submitted to the Missouri Sheriff's Association, and if someone feels a particular need to have it earmarked for the Crime Victims Unit, they can just note that in the memo of a check or of a letter, and that monies that come into the Crime Victims Unit go directly to meeting the needs of victims. We often find that they may need a lock changed on their home. They may need something for a child to start school, or we've even seen victims that needed clothes to go to court. And so we're able to provide a variety of those needs. We've also helped secure security systems for families in need that way. So all monies do go directly to serving the needs of crime victims.
Okay. I really appreciate you being on the show today. And I want our listeners to know that the guest today is Kim Case, a unit manager with the Missouri Sheriff's Association. Thank you so much for taking the time to call us by telephone today. We appreciate the interview, and we hope that anyone that needs your help will contact you in the manner that you have spoken of. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Have a good day.
You too.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition's long-awaited documentary film With Justice and Dignity, A Caravan for Peace, led by Javier Cecilia, the Mexican poet, is now available.
Javier Cecilia is a man of letters, but he's also an enormous man of heart. He put down his pen, but then spoke his poetry to us as a victim of the war on drugs.
He started with leading caravans for peace within Mexico. and they decided to do one from Mexico to Washington, D.C. Our board chair and co-founder, Jack Cole, met with an organization called Global Exchange. Global Exchange was planning to do this Caravan for Peace. So we decided, why not accompany two busloads of families who have been devastated by the drug war? We saw it as an opportunity to educate people of the United States, to help them understand that it is the violence of the drug war, not drugs, that threatens the security of both the United States and Mexico. The Caravan for Peace and Justice carried 110 of the people that were left behind by government and cartel violence. Each of them grieved the loss of loved ones disappeared or murdered by the ferocity of the drug war, and each had a story to tell.
We needed the people in the United States to hear their stories. We needed people here in this country to understand the harms we are doing. Nothing could have been more important to me than getting these people here to testify to what actually had happened to them.
And to expose the harm in personal terms to the Mexican people that the drug habit of the American people and the insistence of prohibition by the American government has imposed on our neighbors to the south.
I think that LEAP as an organization is the most critical voice. We've seen both sides of it. We've seen our failures. We have the ability to change the viewpoints of Americans by humanizing victims. We have a moral obligation to recognize their pain and their suffering and to help end a failed policy.
This film was produced by the former deputy police chief of Los Angeles and the former producer of MacGyver, Steve Downing, who will be our guest on this week's Cultural Baggage program. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.